Chapter 17. The Mystery of the Shemitah. And then he left. So what happened? I tried to figure out the mystery on the seal, the 6 stalks of wheat, and in some way a 7th, but not there, absent. 6 of one kind, and a 7th of another. It turns out it's a biblical pattern, the days of the week. 6 days of one kind, and a 7th day, the Sabbath, different from the rest. But what do the days of the week have to do with wheat? She asked. I had no idea, but that's all I could figure out. And then he reappeared? Several weeks later, I was driving home from a conference out of state through the countryside. It was a rolling landscape with fields of grain on both sides of the road. On my left, the grain sloped upward to a distant crest. The wind was beating against the stalks, making waves throughout the field. I couldn't help looking at it while trying to keep my eyes on the road, a dance of wind, wheat, sunlight, and shadow. Then I noticed something out of place. At first I thought it was a scarecrow. It was the only thing I could think of, the figure of a man standing on the top of the crest, with a long dark coat. It was him. Not that I could be sure from so far away, but I just knew it. So I pulled over to the side of the road, got out, and made my way through the field up to the crest. Nouriel, he said, greeting me as I approached. What brings you to these parts? Ah, of course. What would bring me to these parts? I replied. And would it do any good if I asked you what you're doing standing in the middle of a wheat field? I can tell you I'm not here for the farm work. I knew it wouldn't do any good to ask, I replied. I'm here for the same reason you are. I gazed out at the surroundings. The crest wasn't actually part of the field. The wheat stopped just short of reaching it, and we were surrounded not by one field, but several in every direction, each one rolling away from us and up into the distant hills. So, he said, breaking the silence, have you figured out the mystery of the seal? Something to do with the days of the week. Why do you say that? He asked. There were 6 stalks of wheat, and a 7th one I only knew about because you told me. The 6 were visible, the 7th was not. A pattern of 6 and 7, the same pattern of the biblical week. You didn't get it, he said, but you were on the right track. How so? The pattern is correct. 6 of one kind and then a 7th. And each stalk of wheat represents a measure of time. You got that right. But it's not a pattern of days. Then of what? The same pattern given to Israel to mark their days was also given for their years. For 6 years they were to labor, sowing and reaping their fields, pruning their vines, gathering in their harvests. But in the 7th year they would rest. It would be the Sabbath year. The law of the 7th year came to them in the deserts of Sinai through Moses. Thus they were commanded, "When you come into the land which I give you, then the land shall keep a Sabbath to the Lord. 6 years you shall sow your field, and 6 years you shall prune your vineyard, and gather its fruit. But in the 7th year there shall be a Sabbath of solemn rest for the land, a Sabbath to the Lord." Then each stalk represents a year, I said. Each stalk represents a harvest. Correct. And the missing stalk? The missing stalk would stand for the 7th year. It's not there because the 7th year is the Sabbath year, so there's no harvest. Well done, he said. The 7th year was given a name. It was called the Shemitah. The word Shemitah means the release, the remission, the letting rest. In the year of the Shemitah, all laboring over the land was to come to a rest. There was to be no plowing, no sowing, no pruning, no reaping, no harvesting. The fruits of the harvest would be abandoned, let go. What grows of its own accord of your harvest you shall not reap, nor gather the grapes of your untended vine, for it is a year of rest for the land. Look over there, Nouriel. What do you see? A field with no harvest, I answered. Only the remains of a past harvest. It's fallow ground. The land is resting. In the year of the Shemitah, all the fields of Israel became like that, fallow and resting. But how did they live without a harvest? They would eat whatever grew of itself. 6 years you shall sow your land and gather in its produce, but the seventh year you shall let it rest and lie fallow, that the poor of your people may eat. In the seventh year each landowner was required to open up his land to those in need. The poor would share equally in the fruit of the rich. The land's produce would become, in a very real sense, the possession of all. The wind was now beginning to pick up in speed and strength, its gusts beating down all the more intensely on the stalks of wheat. The resulting waves were now more rapid and dramatic than before. The prophet paused for a few moments as I took it all in, then continued. "But the Shemitah," he said, "touched not only the fields, but also the people. The last remission took place in an entirely other realm. At the end of every 7 years, you shall grant a release of debts. And this is the form of the release. Every creditor who has lent anything to his neighbor shall release it. He shall not require it of his neighbor or his brother, because it is called the Lord's release, Shemitah." Thus the last letting go of the Shemitah would touch the economic realm and transform it. So in the seventh year, all debts were canceled. Everyone who made a loan had to annul it. Those in debt were released. Anything still owed was forgiven. All credit was nullified. All debt was wiped away. "And all this took place at the end of the seventh year?" I asked. "Yes, at the very end, on one specific day, the 29th day of the Hebrew month of Elul, the last day of the civil year, the very end of the seventh year." So the 29th of Elul was the climax, the focal point, and the finale of the Shemitah, the day when the nation's financial accounts were nullified. "But wouldn't the canceling of all debt and the nullifying of all credit cause economic chaos?" "It could," he said. "Most economies are dependent on some sort of system of credit and loans. So the economic repercussions of such a sweeping change would be immense. So immense that over the centuries, the rabbis would seek ways to get around these requirements in the fear that keeping them would cause economic disaster." "But it was supposed to be a blessing," I replied, "a Sabbath." "Yes, a year of release and freedom, a year of rest from one's labors, and of drawing near to God. And yet still, in outward form, it could resemble an economic collapse. But if the Shemitah year was meant to be a blessing, what does it have to do with judgment, or Isaiah 9:10, or America?" "The Shemitah would have been a blessing had Israel observed it and not rebelled against God. But Israel did rebel and didn't keep the Sabbath year. And the breaking of the Sabbath year became the sign of a nation that had ruled God out of its life. The nation had no more time for him. The people were now serving idols. Their Sabbath years would be filled not with peace, but with a restless pursuit of increase and gain. The breaking of the Shemitah was the sign that the nation had driven God out of its fields, out of its labors, its government, its culture, its homes, its life. The Shemitah was meant to be a blessing, but in its breaking, its blessing turns into a curse." "And what does that mean?" I asked. "The Shemitah would still come," said the prophet, "but not by choice, but by judgment. Foreign armies would overrun the land, destroy the cities, ravage the fields, and take the people captive into exile. And the land would rest, the fields would become fallow, the buying and selling of its produce and the flow of commerce would come to a standstill. Private ownership would become virtually meaningless, and every debt, credit, and loan would, in an instant, be wiped away. One way or another, the Shemitah would come." "Does the Bible connect the Shemitah to judgment explicitly?" "Yes," he answered. "The connection was foretold from the beginning, from Mount Sinai. Your land shall be desolate, and your cities waste. Then the land shall enjoy its Sabbaths, as long as it lies desolate, and you are in your enemy's land. Then the land shall rest, and enjoy its Sabbaths. As long as it lies desolate, it shall rest, for the time it did not rest on your Sabbaths when you dwelt in it." And it would all be fulfilled centuries later when the armies of Babylon invaded and ravaged the land and took multitudes into captivity. The people would remain in exile for 70 years. Why 70? The answer was hidden in the mystery of the Shemitah. 70 was the number of Sabbath years not kept? Correct. But now, with the land lying still for 70 years, the law of the Shemitah would be fulfilled, even if not by choice. Correct again. It's ironic. In the pursuit of prosperity, the people drove God and the Shemitah out of the land. But now it was the Shemitah that drove the people out of the land and their prosperity, nullifying all their gains and increase. And it was the Shemitah, he said, in which was hidden the mystery of the timing. The timing? The timing of their judgment. 70 years for 70 Shemitahs. So the Shemitah is meant to be a blessing, but for the nation that once knew God but has driven him from its life, the Shemitah becomes a sign of judgment. Correct, he said. So now let's piece the mystery together. In order to do that, we must first identify the pieces. Record this. I've recorded everything, I replied. The machine's on. I don't mean that. You have your notepad? Yes. And a pen? Yes. You're a writer, Nouriel. Write. So I jotted down the next part in shorthand, as he dictated. The effect and repercussions of the Shemitah extend into the financial realm, the economic realm, and the realms of labor, employment, production, consumption, and trade. Over the course of the 7th year, the nation's production is severely decreased as its fields and vineyards lay fallow. The nation's labor is greatly reduced or comes to a cessation. Its fields become, in part, the possession of all. The buying and selling of the land's produce are restricted. The fruits of labor are abandoned. Credit is canceled and debt is wiped away. For the nation that attempts to rule God out of its existence, the Shemitah changes from a vessel of blessing to a vessel of judgment, the judgment of a nation's prosperity. Did you get all that? He asked. Yes. But what does it have to do with America? America has never had a Sabbath year. That's correct. It was only commanded for one nation. But the issue here isn't the literal observance of the Shemitah or any requirement to keep it. Then what is the issue here? I asked. The issue here, he replied, is its dynamic, its effect, and its consequence. And what does that mean? The issue is the Shemitah as a sign. The Shemitah as a sign? The sign of the Shemitah, given to a nation that has driven God out of its life and replaced him with idols and the pursuit of gain. The issue is the Shemitah as a sign of judgment, the sign that specifically touches a nation's financial and economic realms. I still don't see how it connects with America. Behind the collapse of Wall Street and the implosion of the American and world economy, behind all of it lies the mystery of the Shemitah. Tell me. The economic collapse of 2008 was set off by a series of trigger events in early September. At that time, about half of the American mortgage market was owned or backed up by two corporations, the Federal National Mortgage Association and the Federal Home Loan Mortgage Corporation, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. That's right, he said. And by early September, both of them, along with the mortgage and housing markets, were teetering on the edge of collapse. On September 7th, in one of the most dramatic economic interventions since the Great Depression, the federal government seized control of both corporations, placing them under government conservatorship, in effect nationalizing them. Their seizure caused global alarm, and then just as the mortgage market was reeling from their collapse, an even more economically cataclysmic collapse was about to take place. The fall of Lehman Brothers. At the start of the 21st century, Lehman Brothers stood at the pinnacle of the world's leading financial firms. But when the subprime mortgage market began to disintegrate, Lehman's standing and assets began to collapse. When the news spread that a deal to rescue the ailing firm had fallen through, its shares plunged along with the stock market. The following day, Lehman Brothers announced a loss of nearly $4 billion. The day after that, the firm's stock plunged another 40%, and news spread that it was seeking a corporate buyer. In the following days, a flurry of emergency meetings took place between the Federal Reserve and the leaders of Wall Street in a frantic effort to prevent Lehman's end. But the effort failed, and on Monday morning, September 15th, 2008, 1 week after the first collapse, came the second, and this time with no safety net to break the fall. Lehman Brothers filed for bankruptcy, the largest bankruptcy in American history up to that date. It would be called the collapse heard around the world. The fall of Lehman Brothers would in turn trigger the collapse of Wall Street and the global financial implosion. The worst economic crisis since the Great Depression, I said. So what does it have to do with the mystery of the Shemitah? In the days of the prophet Jeremiah, with Jerusalem lying in ruins and the people taken away in captivity, the key that held the timing of the nation's judgment was hidden in the mystery of the Shemitah. So there's something in the timing of the economic collapse that's significant? The collapse of Lehman Brothers and the American economy took place over the course of 1 week. It was the anniversary week of another American calamity. 9/11. Yes, 9/11, he said. The collapse of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac happened on September 7th. The collapse of Lehman Brothers began 2 days later, on September 9th, when it lost 45% of its value. It was on September 10th that it announced its loss of almost $4 billion. The following day, its stock took a second precipitous plunge. September 11th. It was that second collapse, on September 11th, that Lehman's death knell sounded throughout Wall Street and Washington, D.C. It was then that the Federal Reserve set in motion a series of actions and emergency meetings that would end in the fall of Lehman Brothers, triggering the implosion of the American and global economy. It was also on that September 11th that a second fall reached its critical mass, and a second alarm was sounded as the chief executive of AIG alerted the Federal Reserve of New York that his firm was likewise in critical danger of collapsing. Two alarms of the coming collapse, both sounding on September 11th. So, as the nation was commemorating the calamity of 9/11, a second calamity, one that would ravage the economic realm, was just beginning. And the time separating the two events... 7 years, said the prophet. There were 7 years between the two. 7 years, the biblical period of time that concerns a nation's financial and economic realms. Yes, he replied, and that concerns the judgment of those two realms. 7 years between the first and second shaking. And what happens, Noriel, at the end of 7 years? At the end of 7 years comes the remission. At the end of every 7 years, you will have a release, a remission, a canceling of debts. So it was a remission of what exactly, he asked. Of credit and debt, I answered. And what did all these collapses have to do with? Credit and debt, I replied. So not only did the collapse of 2008 take place at the 7-year mark from 9/11, but it specifically concerned the principle of the Shemitah. The collapse of Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, and Lehman Brothers all concerned the issue of credit and debt. In the case of the first two, the government intervened. It was a bailout. The two corporations were relieved of their debts of over $5 trillion. A remission of debt. The remission of debt, said the prophet, whether temporary or permanent, a form of Shemitah. And in the case of Lehman Brothers? In the case of Lehman Brothers, the remission took on a different form. The government refused a bailout, and the corporation went bankrupt. And by declaring bankruptcy, its debts were wiped away, and its loans were canceled. Another form of Shemitah, he said. Another remission of debt. So the American and global financial collapse was triggered by the dynamic of the Shemitah. Yes, and not only triggered by it. What do you mean? I asked. Stock markets are built on investment. Money is given on the assumption that the investment will generate a return. In that sense, it follows the outward form of credit and debt. Beyond this, the investments come not only from individuals, but also from banking institutions, the funds of which represent loans, credit, and debt. But in the year of the Shemitah, credit and debt are nullified. Exactly. The fall of Lehman Brothers set off an avalanche of financial collapses from Wall Street to Asia. It would continue to cause the convulsion of stock markets around the world for several months, plunging them to ever new lows. Massive fortunes were wiped out overnight. The crashing of stock markets across the world meant that the funds invested had vanished and would not be paid back, at least not for the foreseeable future. Both credit and debt, trillions of dollars worth of credit and debt, had in effect been canceled. Every creditor who has made a loan to his neighbor will let it go, will cancel it. A Shemitah. How far back did it go, I asked, the cancellation of debt in the Shemitah? Back to the end of the last Shemitah, he replied, to the last remission of debt. So the Shemitah would wipe away all the debts of the previous 7 years? Yes. And when the stock market crashed in September 2008, how much was wiped away? All the gains of the past 7 years, and then some. And it touched the entire world. It touched the entire global economy in the form of collapsing markets, vanishing investments, government bailouts, corporate and personal bankruptcies, and foreclosures, each of which was, in effect, a financial nullification. So in each case, whether by bankruptcy, by aid, or by vanishing accounts, the burden was remitted, released. Each becomes a form of Shemitah. Not only each, he said, but all, the whole. The global economic collapse was itself one colossal Shemitah, made up of countless smaller ones. How far does the cycle go, I asked. Every seventh year in the past and into the future? The subject is for another time, he said. The point now is the Shemitah as a sign of judgment. You spoke of a specific day when financial accounts had to be wiped clean, when credit and debt had to be nullified. The 29th day of Elul, the end of every 7 years, the Shemitah's final and climactic day, when all remaining loans, credits, and debts had to be nullified. So does the 29th of Elul have a part in the mystery, I asked? With the fall of Lehman Brothers, the stock market would plunge more than 499 points. Over the next several weeks, the world's financial markets reeled widely from the impact. In response, the United States Congress worked frantically to come up with a plan to reverse the implosion. The result was a bill proposing the largest government bailout in American history. In a surprise turn of events that shocked most observers, the bill was defeated. That morning, September 29th, the New York Stock Exchange began its session with what many saw as an omen: the opening bell wouldn't sound. When news reached the stock market that the rescue plan had been defeated, Wall Street collapsed. In a single day, it plunged more than 700 points. It was the crowning day in the first stage of the global collapse, and in terms of point loss, the worst day in the history of Wall Street. One financial analyst would sum up what happened on September 29th this way. It was this event, more than anything else, that shattered market confidence. Over the next 2 weeks, the Dow fell close to 2,700 points, a decline of almost 25%. The damage had been done. It was the climactic moment of the global implosion and the greatest single-day stock market crash in Wall Street history. Why did it happen, he asked. Why did it happen just when it did? I didn't answer. He paused before revealing the answer. The greatest single-day stock market crash in Wall Street history took place on the 29th day of Elul, the critical and crowning day of the Hebrew Shemitah. My God, I exclaimed. It was the only thing that could have come out of my mouth at that moment. The day when financial accounts must be wiped away, he said. When credit and debt are nullified, and it all happened on the exact biblical day on which it was ordained to happen. On the exact biblical day specifically ordained to touch a nation's financial realm. And the timing. You said that the Shemitah holds the key to the mystery, to the timing of the judgment. Did you verify it? Anna interjected. Everything the prophet told you? The facts? There was now an unsteadiness in her voice. I did, he replied. And it was all true? She asked. It was all true. It's mind-boggling, she said. The biggest crash in Wall Street history and the collapse of the global economy, all the manifestation of an ancient mystery, it's mind-boggling. I told you it would be. That you did. And there's more. Go on, she said. The prophet spoke of the number seven. The Shemitah, he said, revolves around the number seven. It's the seventh year. It begins and ends in the month of Tishri, the seventh month of the biblical year. It's a mystery of sevens. So could there be a mark left by the Shemitah, a sign of the mystery in the number seven? I'm not getting it, I replied. The greatest stock market point crash in Wall Street history took place on the last and crowning day of the Shemitah. That evening, as the sun went down, it was the beginning of Tishri, the seventh month of the Hebrew year. What triggered the crash was the rejection of the largest government bailout in American history, a sum of $700 billion, I said. And how much of the stock market was wiped away that day? Tell me. That which was wiped away added up to 7%. How many points did that 7% amount to? How many points were wiped away in that largest crash in Wall Street history? I don't know, I replied. 777 points were wiped away that day. 777. On the final day of the seventh year. Do you realize, I asked, how many things would have had to be in place for that all to happen? To come out like that? All of Wall Street. The entire American economy, the entire world economy, every transaction, every stock bought and sold, everything had to be in its exact position for it all to happen exactly as it did, at the exact time and to that exact number. Who could have orchestrated all that? God, he replied. I guess he's the only one who could have. Everything I've told you thus far, Nouriel, concerns the end of the Sabbath year. But what about the beginning? Did anything happen to signal the beginning of the Shemitah? Good question, I said. It was a rare opportunity to say such a thing to the prophet. The years leading up to the Shemitah were fat and prosperous. Buying, spending, investing, the stock market, the housing market, the credit markets, everything was booming. But as the Shemitah year drew closer, more and more signs of economic danger began to surface. The rate of loan failures and housing foreclosures began to rise. The financial institutions backing up those loans and mortgages now found themselves in crisis. But the first definitive sign of what was yet to come took place a year before the global economic collapse. It happened in Britain, but as a repercussion of the failing American housing and credit market. In early September 2007, Northern Rock, Britain's fifth largest mortgage lender, collapsed. It was the first British institution to suffer a bank run in over a century. By the end of the crisis, Northern Rock would be nationalized. The remission of debt. It was the first such collapse in the growing credit crisis and a foreshadow of the failures, the collapses, and the interventions that would soon overtake the American and global economy. A first Shemitah. The fall of Northern Rock happened on September 13th, 2007. September 13th, 2007, on the Hebrew calendar, was the first day of the month of Tishri. The first day of Tishri is the day that begins the Shemitah year. So the first major sign of the Shemitah took place on the exact day on which the Shemitah begins. So then, the day of Northern Rock's fall to the day of the greatest stock market crash in history should mark the beginning and end of the biblical Shemitah. And so it does, said the prophet. The exact beginning and end? The exact beginning and end. And what happened in between? In less than a month from the start of the Shemitah, the stock market, which for the previous several years had been rising, reverses its momentum. By early October, its long ascent comes to an end. It begins to fall. As the Shemitah year progresses, the stock market continues its descent, a slow-motion crash. Billions and billions of dollars are wiped away. The remission of credit and debt. With the tightening of credit markets and the plunging of housing prices, increasing numbers of homeowners find themselves unable to make their mortgage payments. More and more begin defaulting on their mortgages, entering foreclosure. The cancellation of loans, another wiping away of credit and debt. And as they default, the firms standing behind those mortgages now find themselves absorbing greater and greater losses. Every creditor must release his debt. And so the economy continues to deteriorate as the absorbing of losses sets off still more crises. Shockwaves reverberate through the financial world as some of the nation's most powerful lending institutions begin to fail. Some are bailed out or bought out through government intervention. Others go bankrupt. Each failure, each remission, each Shemitah triggers the next and the next as the global economy continues disintegrating. Then in late August, early September, as the year of Shemitah enters its last and climactic phase, so too does the financial crisis, with the collapse of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Yes, he said, and then of Lehman Brothers, and then of the global economy, everything reaching the climax on September 29th, 2008, the last and climactic day of the Shemitah. Everything following the ancient pattern. Speaking of the ancient pattern, Nouriel, read back to me what you took down. So I took out my notepad and began reading back the words of his dictation. The effect and repercussions of the Shemitah extend into the financial realm, the economic realm, and the realms of labor, employment, production, consumption, and trade. Thus, said the prophet, the global crisis began in the financial realm, but didn't stop there. Before long, virtually every economic indicator in every major sector of the economy was affected. The crisis quickly spread into the realms of labor, commerce, production, and consumption. Continue. Over the course of the seventh year, the nation's production is severely decreased as its fields and vineyards lay fallow. So the crisis, he said, causes industrial production to decline, and in some cases to cease altogether. As demand dries up, corporations downsize, factories cut back on output, businesses close their doors. The nation's labor is greatly reduced or comes to a cessation. So the crisis batters the labor force. Workers are laid off. Unemployment skyrockets. Its fields become, in part, the possession of all. So private corporations are increasingly bought out, bailed out, and nationalized, or else becoming increasingly subject to the public realm. The buying and selling of the land's produce are restricted. So commerce and consumption suffer a massive decline. Consumers cut back on spending, and sellers grow more desperate to find ways of reviving their sales. The fruits of labor are abandoned. So merchandise sits untouched in stores and piles up in warehouses. The nations that rely most heavily on export trade now suffer extensive economic damage. Credit is canceled and debt is wiped away. And so, he said, the entire global collapse is a manifestation of the ancient mystery of the Shemitah. I have a question. Ask it. The stock market crash happened on the 29th of Elul, the last day of the seventh year. So that day was the end of a cycle of seven Hebrew years. Correct, he said. So then there has to be another part to the mystery. That which takes place on the 29th of Elul would be the conclusion of something that began 7 years earlier. And so there should be something that took place 7 years before the crash. Something connected to it, something that led up to it, something that inaugurated the seven-year cycle. So, Nouriel, how would you find out if such a thing exists? You'd have to count back 7 years from the crash. Which would bring us to what? The year 2001. To September of 2001. The month of 9/11, he said, finishing my thought. So then the seven-year cycle that reaches its conclusion in the global collapse would have had to have begun somewhere around the time of 9/11. It would go along with the Isaiah 9:10 effect. It was 9/11 and the nation's response to 9/11 that led to the economic collapse 7 years later. Good, Noriel. But you were looking for an event of the Shemitah. It would have to be a major event transpiring in the economic realm. And was there such an event? I asked. There was, he replied. What was it? It happened on Monday, September 17th, 2001. It took place in the economic realm, and it would match, and it would foreshadow what would happen 7 years later. And it was? It was the greatest stock market point crash in Wall Street history up to that day. The record would remain intact for 7 years. 7 years until the crash of 2008. Take note, Noriel, of what we have. What do we have? I asked. A 7 year period that begins with a stock market crash and ends with a second stock market crash. We have a 7 year period framed by the two greatest stock market crashes in Wall Street history up to that time. A 7 year cycle beginning and concluding with two massive remissions of credit and debt. Which is what? The Shemitah, I answered. Correct. It happens at the same time as the first and second shaking. And the mystery goes deeper still, he said. What do you think it was, Noriel, that caused the stock market crash of September 17th, 2001? What, I asked. It was 9/11. It was 9/11 that caused the New York Stock Exchange to close down for 6 days, and then, when it reopened the following Monday, to suffer the greatest loss in its history up to that day. The crash of September 17th, 2001 was the aftershock of 9/11. Just as the crash of 2008 was also the aftershock of 9/11, the extended aftershock, the Isaiah 9:10 effect, so each one was an aftershock of 9/11. Two shakings, and there comes a second. And the two events were inextricably bound together, 7 years apart. This too goes deeper still. The biblical year isn't based on the Western Gregorian calendar, but on the Hebrew lunar calendar. So the 7 year cycle of the Shemitah has to be based not on the Western year, but on the biblical Hebrew year. So no matter what date it is on the Western calendar, the Shemitah will always end on the 29th day of Elul on the Hebrew calendar, which in the year 2008 fell on September 29th, the day of the crash. But in other years, the same day in the biblical calendar would fall on a different date in the Western calendar. And? So what happens if we go back 7 years from the greatest stock market crash in history? Back to the other greatest stock market crash in history, the crash of 2001, the one directly triggered by 9/11, on what day did it fall on the biblical Hebrew calendar? Tell me. On the 29th day of Elul. It all happened on the 29th day of Elul, the exact same day, the one day of the biblical calendar ordained from ancient times to cause the wiping away of credit and debt. My God, I said, both of them? Both of them, he answered. Anna now appeared noticeably shaken, visibly pale. Noriel paused from relaying the account to address her response. What? He asked. It's astounding, she replied. The two greatest stock market crashes America had ever known, both taking place on the exact same biblical day, separated by the exact period of time ordained in the Bible, 7 years to the day, both occurring on the one biblical day appointed for the wiping out of credit and debt, absolutely stunning. She paused to collect her thoughts. And nobody saw it? She asked. Apparently not. You were right, Noriel. What do you mean? When you first came into my office and started telling me about this ancient mystery that was supposed to explain everything from 9/11 to Wall Street, to the global economy, to my bank account, I really thought you were crazy. I know. No, I mean actually crazy, clinically crazy. How could you not? It was just way too out there. You'd hear something like this in the movies, or in novels about the supernatural, but not in real life. But I never could have imagined this. How could you have? Accept my apology, Nouriel. There's no need. If I were in your place, I would have thought the same thing. It's just so mind-boggling. I know. September 17th. What about it? It came up before, she said, didn't it? It did. Why did it come up before? The Isaiah 9:10 effect. That was it. The interest rates. September 17th was the day the Federal Reserve slashed the nation's interest rates. That's correct. It was the beginning of the extreme post-9/11 suppressing of interest rates, the first concrete act of defiance in the face of 9/11, and that which would lead to the economic collapse 7 years later. So, she said, that would mean that the Isaiah 9:10 effect began on the day of the Shemitah. It would mean that, he replied, wouldn't it? And therefore, she said, it would mean that it was on the day of the first stock market crash in 2001 that the seeds were sown for the second. And that would make sense, he said. Why would it make sense? Because one Shemitah leads up to the next, and the first calamity leads to the second. Now, I have a question for you, Nouriel. Ask it. The 29th of Elul comes around once every year, correct? Yes. But there's only one Elul 29 that can close the seven-year cycle. Only one could be the actual day of remission, the one that comes around only once every 7 years. So on which Elul 29 did the stock market crash of 2008 take place? I asked the prophet the same thing. And what did he say? Yes. Yes? It was the one. The crash of 2008 took place on that precise 29th of Elul that comes around once every 7 years, on the one and only day that comes around once every 7 years. Incredible! And do you realize what that means? What? She asked. It means that the other crash, the one that happened 7 years earlier, the one set off by 9/11, the other greatest stock market crash in history, also took place on that exact 29th of Elul that comes around only once every 7 years. So then, the two greatest Wall Street stock market crashes not only happened on the same day on the biblical calendar and on the one day of the biblical year ordained to wipe away credit and debt, but each one fell 7 years apart on the exact once in 7 years occurrence of that one Hebrew day. It's beyond amazing, and yet real. And what else did the prophet tell you? I asked him if the biblical Shemitah was still observed. Yes, he said, in the form of ritual. Then was the ritual of the Shemitah taking place on the day of the crash? I asked. It was, he answered. As religious Jews were observing the conclusion of the Shemitah, closing the seventh year in ritual acts, symbolically wiping away their credits and debts, on the same day, the force of a more mysterious Shemitah was operating, causing Wall Street to collapse and astronomical sums of credit and debt to be wiped away, not in symbol, but in reality. But the mystery of the Shemitah could not have been manifested if 9/11 had never happened. And just when it did, at that exact time, without 9/11, the stock market would never have crashed on the 29th of Elul. So 9/11 had to be woven into the mystery of the Shemitah. It had to be, he answered, and it was. And for the crash of 2008 to have happened 7 years later, exactly seven biblical years later, to the day, all the key events from the fall of Lehman Brothers to the vote on Capitol Hill to the actions of the Federal Reserve to the entire global crisis, to every other event that affected the economic realm, from politics to war to culture, every event had to also be a part of the same ancient mystery. They had to be a part, he replied, as they were. I couldn't finish the thought. I couldn't think of any word to describe what it was. Just at that point, the wind again picked up in intensity, sweeping rapidly over the fields and extending the pause in our conversation. And one more thing to note, he said. turning to look directly into my eyes. The Hebrew word Shemitah has one other meaning, which is the fall or the letting fall. As in a collapse? As in a collapse. So you could translate Shemitah as the year of the fall or the year of letting fall. And that's the mystery of what happened, isn't it? Yes, behind everything, the fall of the stock market, the fall of the housing market and credit market, the fall of commerce and business and trade, everything fell. Every bankruptcy, every foreclosure, every financial failure, every plunge of every major economic indicator, the global collapse itself, everything was a fall. And the entire global collapse began with the fall of Lehman Brothers. Which was not only a fall, I said, it was a letting fall. The Federal Reserve decided to let it fall. Yes. So the entire global collapse began with the American government performing an act of Shemitah. And it goes deeper still. How? No human hands could have orchestrated the countless actions, reactions, and transactions required to cause Wall Street and the global economy to collapse and for everything to happen just as it did at the exact times ordained in the ancient mystery. Then by the hand of God, said the prophet, it was his Shemitah. It was his letting fall. His letting fall of the American economic world order. With the collapse of the global economy, new challenges to American power and leadership would be unleashed, a foreshadowing of the ultimate end of the American-led global order. And all triggered by 9/11, I said. And all a prophetic message, he replied, just as it was in the days of the prophet Jeremiah, as he gazed out at a land devastated, devoid of its fruits and harvests, as he fathomed the sign of the Shemitah, the sign given to the nation that has forgotten its foundations, placed its trust in its powers and prosperity, and ruled God out of its life. And now it appears again as a sign to another nation that has likewise ruled God out of its life, a sign to give warning to that nation that apart from his presence, its blessings must turn into curses, and its prosperity must become its judgment. We stopped speaking and just stood there, watching the wind sweep over the fields. It had to have been a good 2 minutes before the silence was broken by the prophet with a question. Are you ready, Nouriel? Ready? For the next mystery? I don't know. I'm still trying to absorb this one. It's a lot to take in. You have the seal? Yes. So I returned it to him, and he in turn then handed me another. Are you sure you meant to give me this one? I asked. Why? It's the scroll. It is. You've already given it to me, 2 times before. And now a third. It's the prophecy, Isaiah 9:10, I said. So what am I supposed to see in it that I haven't already seen before? Nothing, he said. What do you mean? It's not in the seal. It's in the giving. I don't understand. How many times have I given it to you now? 3 times. So there comes a third. A third what? A third witness. Chapter 18. The Third Witness. The third witness. That's all he told me. So there was no other clue, she asked? No. And that was the end of the encounter? Yes. I headed back through the stalks of wheat to my car. The prophet remained in the midst of the fields. Halfway there, I turned back. He was still standing there in the distance, as when I first saw him. Do you need a ride? I shouted back. To where? He replied. I don't know. Maybe to the place of our next meeting. But then we wouldn't be able to meet there, he replied. I reached the car and turned back again. He was still there. I began driving away. I looked back one more time. It had only been a few seconds into the drive, and he was gone. So you really didn't have much to go on this time? No, the slightest of clues, and a seal I had already been given twice before. and I wasn't thinking about either at first. I was still caught up in the mystery that had just been shown, trying to digest it all. It was about an hour into the drive before I began pondering the next one and the meaning of the seal. "But I don't understand," she said. "How could you find anything more? It was already revealed to you twice. What else could it mean? And how were you supposed to figure it out?" That was the hard part. The seal was of the ninth harbinger, the scroll representing the prophecy, the vow, as proclaimed from Capitol Hill. The second time it was given, it still had to do with the vow, but now the repercussions of that vow, the Isaiah 9:10 effect. "So what would it mean given a third time?" she asked. Apart from the seal itself, I only had one clue. The third witness? Yes, but that's all I needed. How? The first two witnesses had already been revealed. And that was enough for you to know where to go? The seal was linked to a place. Where did each witness recite the vow? In the Capitol. Exactly. And just when it hit me, I passed a sign. For Washington? Yes. And you took the sign as a sign? How could I not take the sign as a sign? Now you're sounding like the prophet. My journey changed. I took the exit and headed to Washington, and specifically to Capitol Hill. It was a couple of hours' drive. When I arrived, it was late afternoon, early evening. I made my way to the Capitol building, to the same steps on which the prophet revealed the ninth harbinger. And what happened? What happened is he was there. He was already there. But when you drove away, he was still in the field. Yes, and there was no vehicle in sight apart from my car, yet he was there before me, waiting. "Did you ever ask him how he did it?" she asked. "No, it was enough for me to try to figure out the mysteries. To try to figure out the prophet on top of that would have been too much. So he was standing there on the terrace, in the middle of the steps, overlooking the mall. The sun had either just set or was just about to. The wind was as strong as it had been earlier that day. I made my way up the steps and joined him on the terrace. "You did well to get here so fast," he said, as I approached. "But you were still here before me. Do you remember when we first came here?" "Of course," I replied. "It was when you told me of the ninth harbinger." The ninth harbinger, Isaiah 9:10 in the form of prophecy. Here the prophecy was proclaimed on the day after 9/11. Here the nation vowed the vow to emerge stronger than before. 7 years later, the vow would be undone, with the collapse of the economy. "Yes," he said. "And what event more than any other would bring about that collapse?" "The fall of Lehman Brothers." "And what decision was the most critical in bringing about that fall?" "The decision of the American government to let Lehman Brothers fall." "And when was that decision announced?" "I don't know." "It happened on the first day of emergency meetings in New York City, as the Treasury Secretary informed the leaders of Wall Street that the government had decided not to save the ailing firm. It would let Lehman Brothers fall. It was the most fateful of all decisions in triggering the collapse of the American and global economy. The decision was announced and sealed on the Friday before the collapse, September 12th. "September 12th," I said. "That was the same day that... The same day the prophecy was proclaimed on this hill. It was 7 years from the proclamation of the vow to the announcement of the decision that would cause the collapse of its economy to the day. So the economic collapse was triggered on the 7th anniversary of the proclaiming of the ancient vow. Just as in ancient times, the same vow would ultimately lead to the collapse of ancient Israel. A very dangerous vow. Nouriel, do you remember the biblical requirement of witnesses?" he asked. "For a truth to be established," I replied, "or a judgment pronounced, there must be two witnesses." "Yes, but another number is also mentioned in Scripture. By the mouth of two or three witnesses, the matter shall be established. By the mouth of two or three witnesses, every word shall be established. So too in the matter of a nation's judgment. The first witness appears on the day after the calamity to proclaim the ancient prophecy from this hill. The second witness appears 3 years later to deliver a speech centered entirely around the same ancient prophecy. Each would connect 9/11 to Isaiah 9:10, America to ancient Israel, and each would vow, "We will rebuild." Each unwittingly pronounces judgment on America. So two witnesses had spoken, But the scriptures speak of a third. So could there be a third witness? A third witness to confirm the connecting of the ancient prophecy to 9/11, but now also to the economic collapse. A third witness as a sign that the underlying course of judgment had not stopped, but had progressed to a further stage. Could there be a third witness to speak from an even higher level and on an even greater scale? Higher than the Senate Majority Leader, I asked. Do you know where we are? Capitol Hill. No, right here on this terrace. No, I answered. This is the place where presidents are sworn into office. This is the place of the inauguration? The inauguration, an event filled with hope and expectancy. But in the case of a nation in departure from God and heading to judgment, hope can only come in repentance. Without a change of course, the end must remain the same, and all other hopes must fail. The third witness is... The third witness is the President of the United States. How? I asked. It's evening, he said. February 24th, 2009. The new president comes to this hill 1 month after his inauguration. He enters the chamber of the House of Representatives, makes his way down the aisle to the podium, and is greeted with thunderous applause. The nation's economy is still in a state of freefall, and a tangible sense of foreboding hangs over the future. Even before he utters his first word, the speech is being hailed as the most important address of his early presidency. It will be the first time he stands as president to address a joint session of Congress and the nation, and his moment to give America an answer to its greatest crisis since 9/11. The chamber quiets. He begins. Madam Speaker, Mr. Vice President, members of Congress, and the First Lady of the United States, I've come here tonight not only to address the distinguished men and women in this great chamber, but to speak frankly and directly to the men and women who sent us here. I know that for many Americans watching right now, the state of our economy is a concern that rises above all others. After setting the stage and framing the magnitude of the crisis, the speech turns. But, while our economy may be weakened and our confidence shaken, though we are living through difficult and uncertain times, tonight I want every American to know this. We will rebuild. It's the vow, I said. It's Isaiah 9:10. And note the strangeness of it, Noriel, the peculiarity of its appearance in such a context. We will rebuild was what was declared in the wake of 9/11. But in the midst of an economic crisis, it's hardly the most natural or the most fitting thing to say, except that it fits into the deeper mystery in which the two calamities are being joined together. And the president had no idea he was voicing the central declaration of Isaiah 9:10? Did the first and second witnesses have any idea what they were saying? No, I said, but they knew they were quoting from Scripture. Still, they had no idea what it meant. In the case of the president, he had no idea he was quoting from anything, and he wasn't. He was seeking to inspire the nation. Nevertheless, out of his mouth came the central declaration of the ancient vow. That he proclaimed the same words without even having a quote to quote from is all the more striking. It just happened to happen, I replied, just like everything else. It happened because it had to, one way or the other. The words had to manifest, one more link in the mystery, bearing witness that what started with 9/11 had not ended, but was still in effect and progressing.